Welcome to the Perimenopausal Mamas podcast for hormonal mamas who want to reclaim their own natural state of health to thrive and raise healthy kids. I'm Dr. Lisa Weeks, naturopathic doctor in Toronto, Canada, and I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little boy named Stuart.
And I'm Dr. Tony Reed, naturopathic doctor, birth doula, and hypnobirthing educator in Calgary, Canada, and I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little girl, Frankie. Thanks for supporting us for the past 100 episodes. Don't forget to subscribe and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also support us by visiting our Patreon page, where you can find out how you can join us for our monthly patron webinar, where we do a deeper dive discussion about all things perimenopause.
The information in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not meant to substitute professional medical advice. Always consult with your licensed healthcare provider.
Welcome everyone to the Perimenopausal Mamas podcast. Today, this is Dr. Tony, and I have a special guest. A special guest because he has been the only male still to be a guest on our podcast. And especially since, again, this has been 2 years, 2 years of COVID, 2 years that we've been in this pandemic. And we've been in the trenches together managing this. And now there's a bit of a shift. And whenever and there's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of different opinions out there. There's a lot of different interpretations of research out there around COVID. And it can be tricky to find a good, reliable resource. And for me, the person that I go and look to is Dr. Paul Anderson. Dr. Paul Anderson is a naturopathic doctor and educator with a focus on complex infections, chronic illness, and cancer care. He's the author of multiple books, including Outside the Box Cancer Therapies, and textbooks on IV nutrient therapy. He is a renowned lecturer and educator of clinicians through his website online and through a number of different conferences. As well, he is the host of his own podcast, Medicine and Health with Dr. Paul Anderson. Thank you, Dr. Anderson, for being with us today. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me back. And I didn't know that I was still the only male who's been on your, maybe it's having four daughters who are all grown now really, I've stayed in that female energy for most of my life, I guess. So
there you go.
They don't let me get away with a lot.
Perfect. Well, for me, in my mind, are a go-to when we're really looking at what the scientific research is telling us around what is happening around this SARS-CoV-2 virus, what's happening with COVID, where the pandemic is going, especially because not only in the beginning, I mean, we last talked in September 2020, a lot of things have changed. Things were still so new, so novel. There was no vaccines, other therapeutics just were not on the scene. There was a lot of fear then. And there's still a lot of fear now, for especially for parents out there, just trying to really navigate how to support keeping their families healthy, and really, this idea of even this shift away from the pandemic, I think is there's a piece where we're still kind of used to now this pandemic. We're used to how we've been kind of keeping ourselves safe from the virus. But things are changing. And again, it's a different landscape. This is what viruses do, right? Viruses shift and change. And so I just appreciate, again, what this conversation that we can have around what does it mean now? What does this pandemic mean now? And how can we shift out of it? How should we really view things what are the best ways to support ourselves.
Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you. That I think that's a really good place to start, because it's been a long couple of years at this point. And I think that, you know, first thing that I try and kind of recenter myself to is, it's easy for those of us who are maybe in healthcare, and especially those of us that have patients with COVID that we're trying to help, you know, to get a little tunnel vision focused. And it's easy to also then forget we're a little desensitized to it. But if you get out in the world, there's now two groups of people. They divide up, but there's two big groups of people. One group have either directly had COVID or a family member, and it's gone better or worse. And the other group maybe have either not had COVID themselves or had very peripheral exposure to it. And both groups still have a lot of concern. You know, there's a lot of fear. I think especially when we made the shift from Delta to Omicron, and we were getting breakthrough infections through our vaccines with Delta, and then Omicron, it basically, you know, some hospitalizations actually flipped, where the majority in the hospital were vaccinated. You know, so that just starts to scare people, because you've been thinking, well, if this is the answer, would I do that? And then you have people like, you know, eminent scientists from Europe and then myself looking at the same data and sharing it in a less eminent way here in North America, talking about, well, Omicron is sort of evolved, as viruses do, to be number one, fast spreading, number two, break all the rules. That's what a good viral, you know, evolution does. But number three, also leave us with more population immunity. So now you won't hear as many North American scientists say this, but a lot of the European scientists basically said, this is the perfect natural vaccination for the whole world. Now, I will say, because I get a lot of feedback, both good and bad, it's all there. I am not a proponent. I'm not telling you to go out and infect yourself or whatever. Okay, so don't put those words in my mouth. And I'm also, you know, not saying that, you know, if you and your healthcare provider think your vaccination is for you, please do whatever you and your healthcare provider decide. I'm not saying anything about that. But I think the reality is, what we've seen is, yes, there are still people, not so much in Europe now. In the U.S. and Canada, we were saying, well, Omicron will probably hit 100% of the people by late January or early February, and it's probably going to be like late February where it really hits 100%. Some people are really good at isolating, and they may not be bothered by it, but I am seeing it just, you know, whereas with Delta, it was still very, gosh, you could identify the people who got sick and then the people who were able to avoid it. You know, now it's like those same groups of people get sick, and then the kids get it, and the, you know, mom and dad both have it, and the grandparents, and you can't do a thing about it. So we really have a different game. Now there's always, like, viruses evolve as part of that's their gig. If a virus doesn't evolve, it doesn't last, right? And it's sort of there to last. We could always have more viral changes, you know, more genetic changes and evolution. But the way that things usually go, and I think this is what most of the big time epidemiology folks are saying, is you get this faster, broader spreading variant that doesn't kill as many people, which is true of Omicron, although it does kill some people, but not as many as Delta. You get this wide penetrance around the world, and suddenly you go from pandemic, which is all over, to endemic, which is like we know the flu to be today, or even the common cold. It's with us forever. It usually has a cycle it goes on. It might leave humans and go to an animal, come back different, you know, like swine flu or bird flu. But it's basically there. It's part of our world, part of our life. So I think one of the things to consider on the, you know, the concern and the fear side of things, et cetera, is that's a scary thought to know that, like, a lot of people, initially, especially because we saw it from Southern Africa and then Europe, where Omicron just went no matter what anyone did. And this is when you start to see governments saying, well, there's not much we can do to stop it, so let's just see what happens. North Americans got really afraid of that because it was like, well, if it does that here, what's going to happen? Well, it's doing that right now. So I think that the silver linings really are, although I've had one patient die with Omicron, there were extenuating circumstances and the hospital, you know, did what hospitals do and didn't do enough till too late. But, you know, that happens. But generally speaking, I've seen way more children with Omicron. I've seen way more whole families get it. And most people weather it really well. Kids weather it differently than adults. But yeah, we can take this any direction you want.
Well, and for sure, especially because for me, I was really feeling, especially once Omicron was, you know, coming from Africa and Europe to North America, and even seeing how it was milder, it was spreading faster. I personally was really feeling like, okay, it's inevitable. Like I'm going to get this at some point. I thought it was going to be around Christmas time, around the time that I was going to be with my family, but it was a couple of weeks later. And I shared a little bit of that on a previous podcast that, again, I'll link to that in the show notes, that episode. You've also experienced maybe a little bit earlier than me and shared that on a couple of podcast episodes about your experience with Omicron and that personal experience of having that. And yeah, again, it is different. It is this idea of, you know, people being able, you know, being exposed. And I mean, in my case, I had no idea where I got exposed. Sure. And seeing my daughter have it, but just a little blip of fever and then completely done and fine, it was quite a relief to know that, okay, we are now on the other side of that. Mm-hmm. There are still, again, a number of families out there that really have concerns about, you know, what this is going to mean for their kids in terms of being exposed to it, you know, and really fearing for the health of their kids and their loved ones. And even this question of, again, how it can spread throughout families and that idea of, you know, kids spreading it over to adults and other people who are, you know, at higher risk of having more complications from the virus. Sure. Than for kids. I think, I know for myself, I'm quite an optimistic kind of positive person. So especially in even seeing, you know, some of your previous podcast episodes of like, okay, you know, what does this mean? I want to hold on to this idea that, okay, it's less virulent, it's more mild, we're coming out of this, it'll be okay for kids to get it, it will be okay when most people get it. And there's still those outliers, and there's a lot of parents still wondering, you know, how can I really support my kids, my family? Is, you know, what risk are we at? How are kids responding? Especially because there's different stories out there that may not be founded in the best research and scientific evidence and clinical evidence out there. Right. I know you've talked about that in kind of your previous podcast episodes as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there's a couple factors. When I first started to interact with the European and African scientists about the, wow, this is just spreading like wildfire and there's actually no stop, like it doesn't care about vaccination, it doesn't care about anything, it's just spreading. And it's not like these other variants we've had where you can actually do some environmental things and probably avoid it if you're really good. There were people in, you know, Europe, for example, and other parts of the world that were actually isolated and they still got it, you know? So, I mean, it was that good at spreading. So it was a little disconcerting, you know, because the psychology that we're all dealing with is we basically had 2 years of hearing about how bad this virus is. It's novel. It kills people, definitely does. It can kill you. You know, that's like the perfect, you know, kind of like psychological warfare. Like it's a like a scary mm-hmm. movie. You know, mm-hmm. it's coming. You don't know where it is. You know, it's really bad and it's going to get you, you know. So that's a setup for a lot of anxiety. So, I mean, I remember thinking, gee, you know, am I ready? Because I'm probably going to get exposed. And am I ready to start seeing more children, you know, with this? Because traditionally with the other variants, we didn't see a lot of kids who got sick. And if they did, you know, unless they had underlying problems, it wasn't that bad. But statistically, if you have, you know, all the other variants hit a tiny percentage of kids, that's easier to manage, even if they're sicker kids, because kids are more resilient and there's a lot of room for kids at hospitals. If all the kids get it, like a flu, you know, let's say, and we don't know how it's going to hit kids. And early on, people were kind of fear-mongering, saying, well, it might kill kids. They always say that. It doesn't. It's not going to, and except in very rare instances. But nobody knew how is it going to be to handle this in large quantities of children. And I literally went from seeing, I can't remember the last child in a family who got any of the prior variants. I mean, there were, but it's so tiny. Mm-hmm. To if one family member got it, didn't matter who they were, the whole family got it, from baby to grandpa, grandma. So I think there's a couple of things, though, that are very much silver linings that we were kind of talking about early on, looking at how it went with South Africa and some of the European countries. First thing is, like a good viral mutation, faster spread usually means much lower virulence, and that is true. So if you get it, unless it's unlucky, like my story, when I get it, I do everything my own way. We'll talk about that later. But unless, you know, unless you have other issues going on, it tends to be kind of like a very intense cold flu kind of a situation. You do need to support yourself through it, but also the children. It's a lot like a child getting a cold, you know. And I've seen enough little kids, and again, all the way from, for whatever reason, you know, 0 to 12 has been my sweet spot there. I think older teenagers, it's just like adults, basically. But 0 to 12, what I've seen is, like you said, little babies where they get the fever, they have a little cough, and literally 24 hours later, they're getting better. Little bit older kids, toddlers to, you know, first graders and stuff, maybe fever for a couple of days, definitely a cough. Then they get over it. We had a little outbreak with a couple families because the school had some RSV. That's a virus mm-hmm. kids get in the respiratory system. They kind of had an RSV outbreak, and then Omicron just hit at the same time. Those kids were sick a little longer. But none of them needed to be hospitalized. None had any real bad outcome. They just needed support. But it was very much like supporting a cold or a flu, you know, in a child. The parents tended to feel sicker, as we usually do. And I think that's probably a couple things. One is a little more mature immune system that isn't, you know, little children's immune systems kind of erupt because they're so zippy and they have so much potential. So they get real sick, and then, you know, they kind of, you know, extinguish it. We kind of have like a flash and then another flash, another flash. And so the virus gets a little bit of a head of steam, and then our immune system starts fighting back, and we feel really yucky for a little while. So most of the parents, it's been, like I say, more like a flu, 3 to 5, maybe 7 days. Where the biggest problem being a parent then is you've got kids who are now over it and you feel horrible still, and they're running around, you know, doing their thing. I've done
That was challenging. That was challenging, Dr. Anderson. I don't think my daughter Frankie was very happy with me that I was sitting on the couch, kind of out of it.
They don't.
And she was ready to go.
Yeah, they're like, "Well, I'm better." I did some house calls, and I always put a caveat. Don't ask me to. I have enough. I don't do extra house calls, but I did house calls to families because everyone had it, and I would just look in the eyes of the parents, and the parents are like, you know. And the kids are—they're like, he's better after 2 days, and now he wants to, you know, play ball and run around, and I don't want to do anything, you know. And I did feel bad for them, but I think on the other end of the spectrum, the other thing which is real and we all kind of have fear of is what if Grandma gets it, you know, or what if Uncle Fred, who's got diabetes or one lung or whatever, you know, what do we do with him? Well, the thing is, they're going to get it anyway. Now here's the thing, again, I'm not promoting that we get sick on purpose, but yes, if you have somebody that has extremely high, prior health risks, you know, don't go out of your way to involve them in things. You know, this would be a great time for them to be, you know, separated and do all the stuff and, you know, try and avoid getting sick. But what I have seen, even with people with comorbidity and, you know, things that might make even Omicron worse, is they don't get nearly as sick as with Delta. They're not winding up in the hospital like with Delta. And if they do, it's usually because they were already sick with something else and or, you know, they already had lung problems or, you know, bad combos or like pre-existing lung disease and diabetes flared up at the same time, or, you know, you get it. Mm-hmm. And then it's a matter of, you know, hopefully they have a relationship with their doctor where the doctor already knows how sick they are to start with. And so they're more supportive, you know, during Omicron. But generally speaking, with the people we're the most concerned about statistically, you know, people 60 plus, with comorbidity, we're not seeing those people, you know, wildly filling up the hospitals or dropping dead and all of that stuff. Certainly I've seen, you know, some outliers where people did die due to other issues. So I think statistically, well, you know, it's sort of like watching a car wreck coming your way. Nobody wants to see it come. It's already exposed most of the world. North America, I think in the next 4 or 5 weeks, those of us who weren't exposed already are probably going to get exposed. And cool thing is, like a lot of the children, a lot of the adults don't have much disease from it either. They feel a little rough for a few days and then they're fine. I do think, and we don't know the answer to this question I'm about to pose, but I think it'll be interesting because it's very much, Omicron is very much a non-respecter of vaccination versus unvaccination as far as infection goes. And we knew that from Delta too, but much bigger deal with Omicron. Would it be curious if anyone's keeping track, and I don't think it's going to be North American agencies, but probably Europeans, is are we seeing some persistent either herd immunity from natural immunity or vaccination immunity or combos? Does that also maybe help with your disease process, you know, or not? Initially, when this big, you know, wave was sweeping Southern Africa, Europe, and then over here, what we were seeing was, you know, more infections in the vaccinated and in some Canadian towns, more, you know, hospitalization. But it takes a while for those statistics to wash out. That might have just been those people were right on top of getting help, you know, so that could be a statistical anomaly. So I do think that on the order of this big bad thing that we've been afraid of for a couple of years, we've only heard bad stories about it, and we may have known people who have died. I certainly do, or got real sick or whatever. So no fun. But I think in the virus's natural evolution to going from a pandemic to burning itself out and just coming back periodically, endemically, I think we're there. There might be one more, you know, one more Greek letter or not, but I think, and even you know, even Dr. Fauci is saying we're there, you know, I mean, he's usually the last person to kind of go out on a limb on stuff like that. So I think there's more good news than bad. I think just naturally dealing with the virus, our bodies are better set up with Omicron than the other ones. And then I think some of the stuff that you and I both talk about a lot, just the staying healthy things become very important when you have something like Omicron.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I mean, there's so many things to touch base on, because I do want to hear about a little bit about your personal experience, especially that idea of, again, kind of underlying health conditions and this idea of co-infections, which I truthfully hadn't thought a lot about until, again, you had brought this up, in not only in your experience, but again, your other experience of dealing with infections in your patients. The idea of natural immunity and what the research is saying on that, natural immunity versus, you know, vaccination, or even that combination of natural immunity with vaccination.
Right.
And then also, I mean, this idea of the virus shifting. One of your podcast episodes was great because you took the time to go through this peer-reviewed journal article going through the actual genetics of the different variants and showing how different Omicron is compared to Delta and all of the other variants. Now, I mean, the first thing that pops into my mind, especially thinking of the most concerned, most anxious parent out there around the pandemic, is, well, what's the possibility that we could get another variant that is worse, that is more virulent than Omicron? Or is it guaranteed that it's going to stay mild? I don't know if you have your crystal ball, or if the research out there has a crystal ball.
So I think that is a good question to get cleared up in our minds. The very most centrist, middle of the road virologists will say pretty much the same thing, which is, you never know with a genetic mutation, you know, where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. And so you could always have a bad one come next. But the way viruses that want to persist in the human population normally do it is, they're novel and they're real bad. And then they have some mutations that make them a little bit more transmissible, but they're still kind of nasty. And then eventually they get to a mutation that spreads fast, but doesn't kill people as much. So low virulence. And if you think about it from the virus point of view, even though they're not supposed to be sentient beings, mechanically they do this, right? From the viral point of view, I don't want to kill a lot of people. I want to infect a lot of people, because that's how I reproduce, right? So normally genetic mutations trend towards high infectivity and low danger. You could get a wild type, you know, that comes out or whatever. But what most of the, you know, viral epidemiologists will also tell you is, once you hit something like Omicron, where it's kind of hit most of the world, the chance of enough population to make a new variant that's of any consequence is pretty low. Or if there is, it's going to be another one kind of like Omicron. So, for example, there was a lot made about, Omicron, there's like a second Omicron or whatever it is. Yes, there is, but it's absolutely no different disease. I think they call them B1 and B2, and they literally are just a little split in the genetic code. So they do the same thing, you know, and that'll probably be our ticket to, you know, pandemic immunity. So, yes, you never know. There could be a wild type that's really horrible that comes back, or a mutation that comes back. But traditionally and statistically, that's not normally what these viruses do. So I'm going with history of virus and statistics and also just penetrance in the human population now. And I think that the other thing then that people need to think about, because right before we came on, probably because I was trying to get my browser open. You know, now they give you news flashes and things on your browsers. I don't know how to turn them off. So they're there. And it was like, prepare, you know, COVID's with us forever. And what does that mean? And people were very stern. And it was like, well, of course it's with us forever. And they were had a very particular point of view. They were sort of pitching there. Yes, COVID's with us forever, like influenza, like the other coronaviruses are. You know, all the coronaviruses we've had, or most of them prior, are cold and flu type of, you know, cold type viruses. It's going to be one of those. Could it do like flu virus does and others? Could it decide it's bored with being so transmissible and now it can't infect any humans? And could it go back to an animal reservoir and change enough to be reinfectable? Sure. That's, you know, that when they say endemic and it'll come back, that's what they mean. Now, here's the thing. Natural, so you got three buckets of immunity. You've got natural immunity, which means I had COVID. Now I have natural immunity. And you know, most of the data earlier that was saying, oh, if you've had COVID, the antibodies don't last and all that, they've shown very clearly that that data was not looking at the right things. Okay, your T cells have memory, and also the right kind of antibodies stick around. So natural immunity, it turns out, is as or more potent than vaccine immunity. But what if I had a vaccination? Well, the difference, and this leads to the middle group, which is what if I had both? I got a mix, you know, I got some vaccine or maybe all the vaccines, and I got COVID on top of it, as I've seen a lot of. How does that change my immunity? Well, if you have vaccine immunity, well, there's limits to what I'm about to say. The idea is the vaccine is engineered to drive a particular portion of the virus as what you recognize with your immune system. That can be broader or more narrow, but the we've picked on, in vaccinology, we picked on the spike proteins and then a few other, you know, chunks. Now, this is fine. You have to pick on something. You know, if you look at other vaccines, there's usually a chunk, you know, of the code or an outer protein or something that you're trying to sensitize the patient against. If you have a mutation, like this happened a bit with Omicron, where it picked up some genetics from some cold type viruses, some non-corona cold type viruses. And so it became a little more able to get into the human, you know, faster. Thankfully, higher up in the respiratory system, like a traditional coronavirus, rather than down low, giving us a lot of pneumonia, again, unless you're me. So it did that by, you know, merging. So it didn't go to an animal. It went to another virus, picked up some tricks. So one of the reasons that they're theorizing that the vaccinated just, you know, really Omicron just kind of walked through the vaccination was we had a lot of, say, spike protein, you know, recognition, but Omicron had all these other ways to kind of sneak in the back door. Now, what they're calling now is, so group A, infection creates your immunity. Group B, vaccination creates your immunity. And then group C, which is growing now, is some are all vaccinated. So, you know, 1, 2, 3 doses, whatever, plus disease. That by rights ought to give you as broad of coverage as natural immunity does. Initially, when Delta first started, they were saying, well, if you did get sick and then you got vaccinated, you'd have super immunity. And now they're sort of modifying that message to say, well, those of us who have been sick with or without vaccine probably have super immunity already, because we built, you know, you get a natural viral infection. Your T and B cells now have recognition, not just of a spike protein, but all the other pieces that go along with it.
And not just an antibody against the spike protein of the virus.
People want a little, it was very popular, two 12-minute videos on T and B cell immunity. One's just general, but the other is about COVID and how that works. And your immune system has many parts, but the two big ones are cell mediated, which are the T cells, and humoral or antibody, which are the B cells. We focus on B cell immunity because, frankly, it's easier to test. That's the only reason we focus on it. But they work together. So you can literally have no antibodies and T cell memory, and there are special T cells that will tell your antibodies to make new antibodies. So it's a really wonderful system if it talks to each other, you know. So so I think that, you know, the big upside, and again, my you know, my sympathies to any family, you know, where you all get sick, because I've been seeing that, been through it myself, the whole thing. And my sympathies to anybody who does have a relative who maybe gets very ill or passes away, because that does happen, but less so with Omicron. But by and large, the majority of people, you know, we're going to get sick, vaccinated or not. We're going to develop better immunity. And then, you know, in some time period, usually it's annually, but who knows, it'll come back around with some new tricks, and, you know, a smaller group of people will get it. And that's what you'll see.
For sure. And I mean, I feel fortunate being in Alberta, because we are definitely one of those areas, especially in Canada, where the data reporting around cases and hospitalizations has been, I think, really robust, and something that I've kind of just really been checking on, especially in the past couple months, and I think really clear in terms of that idea of what you were talking about, how the vaccine hasn't necessarily acted in the same way with Delta and Omicron. And we are seeing, you know, high percentages of people who have been vaccinated still, you know, being testing positive, but also being in the hospital, and also looking at that idea of even, you know, the government of Alberta and Alberta Health has actually like broken it down to say, this is how many people have had no shots, are in the hospital, one shot, two shots, three shots, so that we can really still see, okay, this is not discriminating on anyone based on vaccination status.
Yeah, definitely the move, you know, with Delta, we were kind of seeing that. With Omicron, it definitely moved. And I was going to say, so most of the time when I see those statistics, it's usually European countries. But actually, in my last podcast, the long one anyway, I think it was COVID Me Part Two, I linked a link to the Alberta hospital system, because they had the most clear reporting, and it literally went zero vax, one vax, two vax, three vax. And it was amazing. Like, and you know, yes, I mean, the other provinces will say, well, you guys don't have that many people there. It's easier to keep track of you guys or whatever.
True, true.
But still, like, you know, the hospital system isn't likely to be lying to you when it comes to that sort of stuff. Because I had people like really upset, like, you know, commenting that couldn't be right and all that. So I just put the link into my last YouTube, and darn if it wasn't there. And it was the same, you know, in the early Omicron trainings podcast I was doing, I was relying on the Danish data collection system is second to none, and some of the other European ones. And they were already starting to report that before Omicron really got here. So I think the important thing is not so much, well, you know, vaccine good or bad, or, you know, well, shoot, I got vaccinated with Omicron or whatever. You know, the world's going to play out the way it plays out. Mm-hmm. The virologists and immunologists in Europe already were saying, well, with this trend we're seeing, we're just going to think of this as a literal global booster. Whether you've been vaccinated or not, this is a global natural, you know, natural immunity booster. We can't stop it. We can't vaccinate away from it. So, you know, let's just do the best we can to keep as many people, you know, safe and healthy as possible. So I think that's the real silver lining, is at least we're not dealing with, you know, like a beta or even a bad Delta or something, and it's everybody getting it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then there's also a piece, I mean, I don't even know if I want to touch on this at all, of because so many people are having such a mild response to Omicron, even something that you mentioned in a podcast episode recently is looking at hospitalization numbers, because again, this whole piece of not wanting to overwhelm our healthcare system is really important.
Right.
But then still, even like when I'm checking the numbers, because I even checked them today in looking at, you know, hospitalization numbers in Alberta. And again, we're still at 70% vaccinated, 30% unvaccinated. But also this idea of, well, are these people sick with COVID? Or are these people going to the hospital for other reasons and they happen to have COVID?
Right. And I think that, you know, it used to be if you brought that topic up, you know, the pitchforks and torches would come out right away.
I hope I don't have any pitchforks or torches coming towards me now.
But I think that the way that I like to look at that, and I think Omicron softened that discussion quite a bit, is even in the very first data out of the hospitals in Southern Africa, where we believe this started, although it was already around the world by the time we knew it was there, they were breaking down how many people, because, okay, you go to the hospital anywhere in the world pretty much now, you're going to get swabbed for COVID and a bunch of other stuff, which is great because then we just know where you stand. But they were actually breaking down, and then the Europeans started to do it. How many people were there because they broke their leg and they happened to swab positive for COVID with no symptoms, or how many people came in because they had a cough and a fever and that was their only problem? And earlier data, and I shared this, it was a little bit more specific, but basically there was almost a majority of people in the Southern African and some of the European countries who were just incidentally diagnosed and they were really there for some other reason. So yes, you're hospitalized with COVID, and say 45 or so percent were actually hospitalized because of COVID. So it's a pretty big difference. So a lot of times too, yeah, you look at gross hospital numbers, and if you tease that out in the person, and here's the thing, you know, you have to be a little bit careful with hospital numbers. If I broke my leg, I go to the hospital, but I also, you know, have the pneumonia because of COVID, well, I have two problems then. Okay, so I'm hospitalized probably because of COVID and my broken leg. But what they were saying from Europe and Southern Africa was most of the people in that, say, 40-ish percent group didn't have any symptoms of COVID. They just happened to be swabbed and came up positive. So I think that's kind of the way that we're looking at it. I will say, you know, Alberta being an outlier, most of North America likes to do inflammatory reporting because that's what gets people to watch. And I understand that, but it's not good for the fear factor, you know, all around other people. So when you see a lot of these numbers, just know that there's a lot in there that's real, but then there's a lot that's probably add-on stuff. And again, you know, we've known this since early in this 2-year process, but it's just now becoming sort of okay to point out, too much trouble. Yeah.
Hopefully. And again, people can visit your podcast episodes and see all of the links that you provide in terms of the peer reviewed research and journal articles around what has been going on in Africa as well as in the European countries as well.
With very few exceptions, I do try to always have links because A, people are curious, and B, you know, as we all know, if you say something that isn't what we've been hearing on the news the last 2 years, it's different. Even if it's true, you have to point people to why you believe that or where you heard it or whatever, or things go very badly. So yeah, I do try to cite things really well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And now, especially with this idea of, you know, going to the hospital with pneumonia because of COVID, this comes into play of looking at not only, you know, people's health status when dealing with this virus, but also something like you shared with your experience of this idea of co-infections. And I mean, I also have to say it was kind of one of those things when I was positive and really looking to recover. Of course, I was very mindful of really doing all I could to get 100% because I didn't want anything else to kick up and to like get 95% better and then have something else kind of rear its ugly head. I even had read an article, and again, I don't remember where it was, I'm not sure if there's any peer-reviewed research around that, but I think you've given some links in previous episodes of yours around COVID and the co-infections, because one thing that came to my mind, I almost had a flashback of having mono, which yeah. is related to a virus like Epstein-Barr virus. And I was even thinking back to some of the things that I did to really support myself through mono when I was starting naturopathic school and working at a naturopathic clinic and having access to things like IV vitamin C and other nutrients to really support my immune system so that I could really fully recover from that infection. That was the thing that popped into my mind when I was experiencing, dealing with COVID. And it was something that you really talked about really specifically for yourself, knowing your health history, some of the infections that you've had to deal with in the past and even more in the present because of COVID.
Yeah, it is a huge issue. And the reason it doesn't get as much play, I think, because they've been publishing about co-infections and COVID from almost since day one, basically. So way back 2 years ago, just about, to the week when I was being asked to comment on vitamin C because that was my research for cancer. And they said, well, the Chinese are using vitamin C in the hospital IV and is it the same and all this. So I went into the Wuhan hospital system, computer system, and got all of their files that they were and all the data they were keeping and had it translated. And sure enough, there was all the vitamin C stuff, which I've done whole things about. But then also there were, totally not surprising, but there were all of these paragraphs that they were saying, okay, we're seeing this, we're seeing this, we're seeing this. Excuse me. So some were, we're seeing diabetics with worse disease. We're seeing, you know, obviously people with lung disease, you know, whatever. But then there was this one on other infections. And I looked and I said, that makes total sense because, you know, we know if you have influenza and you just have influenza, you're more likely to live as opposed to if you have influenza and pneumonia or influenza and some other nasty bug or a fungus. So I started looking at those bugs and then I started looking at research from other parts of the world. And in 100% of research studies where they looked for COVID plus did people have other bugs, they find other bugs. That's the easy part. Now, in my last podcast, I'm getting ready to record another one. So hopefully just a happier topic like staying healthy. But the last podcast was COVID Me Part 2. People were really like giving me a hard time about this co-infection idea. So in the description on YouTube, I abridged my references for co-infections and COVID. It's 3 pages long of references. So this is like 1 or 2 papers, okay? Everybody who's looked has found them. Now, they're geographically usually a little skewed because we don't have the same bugs that they might in Wuhan or they in Southern Africa or wherever. But there's families that you see. One that is ubiquitous in the world that you brought up was the idea of feeling like you're having mono. Okay, again. Well, mono is caused by 2 cousin viruses, mostly Epstein-Barr, but also cytomegalovirus, which are HHV4 and 5. And they are latent in almost all of us. Like they're sitting around and not doing anything. during the cold and flu season, people are coughing them on each other. And if you get weakened, it's not uncommon that they come back. Well, we now have research papers showing that both of those viruses are definitely reactivated when you have COVID. But here's the thing, because people will say, well, you know, because I got, and we'll get to my story, but I had kind of an extreme case and all this, and I did all this stuff that I don't have to do for most of my patients. Most people were saying, well, why did you do all that stuff? You know, I just rested for a few days and I was better, or, you know, I did this and I was better. And it's like, well, you only do what you need to do. And if people have an intact immune system that doesn't have any chinks in the armor, and you get Omicron and that's all you get, it's like the little kids, you know, boom, you're working your way through it. Little kids shorter, adults a little bit longer, but that's all you got. The problem that we're seeing, and the hospitals are in North America are way too slow to evolve to this. And this is an area where I have definitely seen my hospital side patients die. Okay. Now I do need to say, if they're outpatient, like the families I see and all that, usually I'm in control of their care. If they get to a hospital, I am giving consulting advice, if it will be listened to, and other stuff, and I'm supporting the family. So I'm not in charge of anybody in a hospital right now. On the hospital side, the only person, for example, I have seen die of Omicron, sadly, had co-infections. We tried to say this when they went to the hospital. We didn't have testing before, but they were acting like it. And the hospital said, well, they've got Omicron. We're going to do our standard protocol, you know, remdesivir and a couple things. And we'll see if that doesn't work. Well, the problem was they weren't getting better. Then they went on a ventilator. Then they called infectious disease specialists who said, gee, if we could have got here when the person first came to the hospital, we could have treated these bugs. They started to treat them. The person was dead in 2 days because they didn't. You can't eradicate those nasty bugs in 2 days, especially if you're on a ventilator. So it's just tragic and sad because that was totally avoidable. You know, thankfully, you know, that doesn't happen to very many people. But if I look back at the patients who on the hospital side of my practice, I've been consulting with families. The people who passed away tended to either have very bad comorbidity, so uncontrolled diabetes, some heart trouble, lung trouble, obesity, et cetera, that kind of constellation, and or co-infections that weren't addressed till it was too late, or maybe both. So co-infections are a big deal. Now, knowing, and unfortunately, I had already had to deal with, you know, the one patient who passed away and the family and getting them through COVID and the other families before I got it. So when it came my turn, I know my history and I kind of know how I react. And one of the things with people is COVID, I call it sort of the great door opener, and it's not to good things. Like If you tend to get pneumonias, it'll open the door and let them in. If you tend to get fungal infections or other stuff, it'll just open the door. If you're one of those people that's all, you know, kept the Epstein-Barr at bay most of your life because you learned it was bad for you, it'll open that door back up, you know, and you have to get on it and do stuff. And, you know, you and I both know, and everyone knows logically, if you have a little door opening, it's better to squash the problem there rather than let it make you debilitated, you know, or worse. So I just, and I should just, so you know, the other end of the story, not planning this at all, but in early, let's see, it's been such a wild few years.
I know. What year is it?
I know. It's 2022.
So I sometimes forget.
We originally called it COVID-19 because China, you know, came out of the closet and said, we have this novel virus in 2019. And they're walking back the dates that they're now admitting that it was actually there. Well, I was in China in early 2019 before any of this was talked about. And I was there teaching with a group of physicians, and we were at a mostly teaching hospital staff. It was great. And the group of us all arrived extremely healthy. Two of us during the trip got very ill. And one was already sick with some other stuff. I was healthiest I'd been in a long time. So, you know, it was a bigger drop for me than the other doctor. And then interestingly, kind of like we see with COVID, the rest of the group really didn't get sick, or they got like mild stuff. So we developed this problem that, and of course, this is early 2019. We get home from China, and my colleague died. Went to the hospital. They had other pre-existing conditions, which included some nasty infections. They and I were both sick with the same stuff. They died. I could not figure out what was wrong with me. I got all this testing done. And of course, back then there was no testing for these things. And I kind of shopped my case around. At one point, my airway was literally the size of my finger, which is not good.
No, that's small.
And in consulting with people, I was like, I know I've got infections. I don't know what, I know it's a virus, so open the door. And somebody said, you know, if I didn't think it was crazy, I would say you had a SARS virus. And now I know I did have a SARS virus. So he and I had some sort of, I call it SARS-CoV prime. So it's an unknown number. It was a lot like the first SARS that killed people rather quickly, but not quite. It was a lot like early nasty COVID, but of course we didn't have a name for it then. And so I honestly believe that that actually protected me through the early variants, because I don't get easy bugs, but like swine flu I've had twice. The other weird influenzas, I don't get normal influenza. I get the weird ones. So I know myself this way. So I think it did protect me, because I was treating a lot of people with COVID, never got it. Omicron comes around. It's got this new, you know, other viral thing. So it gets me. So I was ready, and I knew, well, what reactivated back when I had this other SARS-like virus. And I knew the list. So the first few days I was kind of like everybody else, and there's a tell, and this is something I would share with people to watch for with your friends and family, mostly us folks over 60 or otherwise maybe not so healthy. But if you get to day 2, 3, 4, and then you start to feel better, that's great. But if you then start to get sick again, that double hump is almost always associated with other infections that COVID just opened the door to. And now so COVID's the least of your worries at that point. Then it was other things. Now, COVID is known to allow in some really nasty lung viruses. It opens the door, as we said, to Epstein-Barr family, you know, those, then there are others. It opens the door to the atypical pneumonia bacteria, which I have a long history with. They were part of my problem with the original SARS. You know, so I started to get worse, checked for those things, and darn if they weren't there, and just very aggressively treated it. So, you know, when people would say, well, you know, I didn't need to do that, it's great. I hope nobody needs to do that. But the people I see who tend to get the sickest, it's, oh, gee, I'm feeling better. And if they're you hopefully will appreciate this. If they're male, in my experience, even that short time of feeling better, they feel they don't need to do anything anymore because they're magically going to get better. And I know it's not always, but it's always the guys. It's like the guys are my worst.
Generalization now, Dr. Anderson.
It is a generalization, but in my personal experience, it's been all the guys. And so what happens then is you think, oh, I'm free. And then, bam, you get hit really hard. Well, you get hit really hard in the second wave, not so much from Omicron. It's the other things. It's those three pages of co-infection research. So my only advice would be, because it's this is not unknown to your doctor. Okay. They understand the concept. They just, no one has really promoted the idea that COVID has so much research with other infections in our sicker patients. So we're not thinking of it, you know, other countries maybe. And I will say, you know, if you go to the hospital, they'll screen you for a couple of big bad bugs, you know, but they won't be looking for these other things till it's too late. So basically, if you're hitting a second wave that seems way worse than when you first got sick, and you know yourself, like in your case, you know, you had mono before, or you know you're chronic Epstein-Barr, or you know you get these atypical pneumonias, hopefully you have a relationship with your GP or somebody and they know that you have this history, and, you know, maybe say at least humor me and treat me for it or test me for it. Or, you know, I get really sick and these things happen. So can we look at this as all of it together? Because your doctor's not going to naturally say, they're going to blame everything on COVID. And yes, that was what opened the door to all this nastiness, but, it's not probably what's keeping you sick. So I think except in children with really bad underlying lung disease, you know, like CF and some other things, I've not seen this phenomenon in children. Now it could happen, but I've not seen it. It tends to be adults. To be my demographic. I've seen it down to 50 with other problems, but, you know, just keep an eye on it. And that sort of double worsening is almost always other bugs.
And I think that's so important to point out, not for ourselves for sure, especially, you know, as we're older and we've had more exposure for different bugs and that kind of thing, but even for those kids and those younger people who have had more of a unique, extraordinary experience with different viruses or bacteria, to really keep that in mind. And I mean, you described in your podcast episode, again, kind of keeping up with those nutrients that we talked about way back in September 2020, the things like vitamin C, N-acetylcysteine, your vitamin A, D, K, quercetin. Especially where you're at in the States, and just even with your experience with infections, co-infections, cancer care, you are not shy about adding in more prescription antibiotics, antivirals, antimicrobials as well.
If you have somebody where their immune system is likely to get behind fighting these things off, which if you're already run down from 4 or 5 days of COVID, you more likely have a tough time with the new bugs. Either extremely aggressive botanical, you know, herbal things, and what I always mix, you know, but prescription things, because it's a super minority, but in people that get bad co-infections, they get out of control very quickly with COVID. And these are the people that wind up on ventilators or die or other stuff. And it just, you know, it's like, yes, so that's less than 1% of people. But just because it's a small number of people doesn't mean you ignore them, you know, and let them get really sick. So I really want to make the point that the majority of people, it's a mild illness. The majority of people don't have these lingering things. But if you do, you know, that's a big area to consider, you know, these other infections. And going back to the nutrients, so way back, you know, forever ago when we last talked, I think I had the newsletter out about the nutrients, and
yes,
the link to it on the website I'll give later. There's only more evidence in the science now for the same group of nutrients. So the nutrient group really hasn't changed a whole lot. It just has more backing, to the degree that there was, this is probably 6 weeks ago, I did a podcast. One of the things I shared was a research from Europe is two research groups from, I think, Israel and another in a European country. The higher your vitamin D levels, less likely the severity of illness would be, and all, you know, all the good things that we were saying. So that was actually some, you know, COVID research with it. So definitely for nutrients, you know, people, the the newsletter with the references I wrote up. It hasn't changed. Obviously doing the things that keep us healthy sort of, you know, endemically, like sleep enough, if you can, you know, if you have little kids. I know we had 5 children and now we have a bunch of grandchildren and they will take your sleep away, but sleep as much as you can, stay moving, you know, drink enough water, don't eat junk food, don't eat things that spike your insulin, all the stuff your grandma would have told you anyway. And then on top of that, you know, all this junk going around, the supplements really can't hurt.
Yeah. And it's interesting because even, you know, back, oh goodness, when I really was thinking, okay, I need to get Dr. Anderson back on, you actually co-authored an open letter to health authorities, public health authorities down in the States with Dr. Paul Herskew, really recommending that public health authorities start talking about these nutrients and actually how to keep us healthy. And we still haven't necessarily heard a lot of that from.
I would say Dr. Herskew and myself have not heard back from anybody that they're going to change any behavior. But, you know, our point really was, look at all the data in the rest of the world. Omicron is coming. We can't do a darn thing about it. Why don't we talk about being healthy? You know, I mean, it's what can it hurt really? Mm-hmm. And in the letter, you know, it was even a little bit of bridge group of nutrients, but it was the core nutrients that are, you know, pretty affordable, pretty easy for people to get. And even if it reduced severity or, you know, kept a few people out of hospitals or whatever it did, what's the harm? You know, from a public health point of view, of saying these are things you could consider. So at least it's out there. I forget how long ago we put that out, 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever. It's been a lot of crickets, though, hearing back from people. I'm glad you heard about it because I was like, did anybody see this?
Yeah. Well, again, I keep tabs on you, Dr. Anderson and Dr. Herskew. You've been really forefront, especially in the naturopathic community, of looking at really managing the past 2 years and definitely some lights in the shadows of all of the negative information, but really looking at how can we be proactive? What is the research in terms of nutrients and how we have the ability to impact our health? Again, not completely, but what can you do? What are the things to do to really fortify yourself and really support your resources to manage? Because there's always going to be viruses. There's always going to be different bugs that we are exposed to.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and let's say there was a magic off button for COVID, you know, there will be other viruses. It's just how humans and viruses work. You know, we hope not one like what's happened with COVID, but there's no reason we aren't going to have other issues. So, you know, staying healthy is your best defense no matter what.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, Dr. Anderson. So we talked a lot about your podcast and all the information that you provide. What's the best way for people to connect with you and find out all of those juicy details of all the research that you go through and all the links that you provide?
So, I have a hub website now that regardless of what you're looking for, there's links to the podcast, there's links to newsletters, links for healthcare providers, for doctor stuff, and whatever else I do. And it's just Dr. A Now, DRANOW.com. So DRANOW.com. And all of the media things I do are linked there and you can find them. These longer, like hour-long podcasts where I usually have the references and that business, that is YouTube is where we house most of that. But there's also, you'll find the newsletters in there about, you know, vitamin C in COVID and nutrients in COVID, which is a really great summary of if you're going to take vitamins and other things, where do you start? It's all there, dranow.com.
Perfect. And, you know, when we're on the other side of this pandemic, maybe I'll have you on to talk more about, you know, co-infections and all of the research around vitamin C and all of the, the other great work that you do as well, Dr. Anderson.
Love to. All right.
Excellent. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So let's switch gears and let's go with talking about my super mom moment, my mama mess up for the week. You know, again, talking about viruses, there's always going to be viruses. There's always going to be things that we're exposed to. You know, was really, sometimes you just have to go with it and look at risk and go with it anyways. The other day we took Frankie and my niece to an indoor play area and had lots of fun. It was so great to again, have some play. It felt wonderful to see the girls running around. It was just a really great evening and a great little outing. I mean, that being said, in that kind of environment, you never know what you're going to pick up. And now a mama mess up might be, okay, we might have a little bit of a cold virus happening at our house that we're dealing with. And thankfully, with Frankie's immune system is really great. It's mild. And it's kind of one of those things where, again, with our kids, we can't necessarily protect them and shield them from everything. Their immune systems need to get exposed so that they can develop properly. So a little, you know, pros and cons, a super mom moment turn into a mama mess up, but still, maybe again, this is the best thing, to do as a parent as well, as to expose her to really mild viruses, not, that are just out there, not on purpose. And my, again, my mama must have for today, I think all of us really need, some really trusted voices in terms of education and research and what's happening around the pandemic. And definitely that for me is Dr. Paul Anderson. So definitely visiting his website, dranow.com, to get all of that information, especially if with this conversation, you want to really link to the research that we talked about today and find out and dig in for yourself. Again, it's there for you if you want to. Don't feel like you have to. That's where we can always look at, you know, how Dr. Anderson is so great at summarizing that research and really what it all means. So thanks so much for joining us today. Again, our show notes will be at our website, perimenopausalmamas.com. You can connect with us on Facebook and Instagram. We'd love for you to subscribe. If you enjoyed this episode, leave a review and a 5-star rating. And again, you can also support us on our Patreon page as well. And you can tell your perimenopausal mama friends about us too. Stay safe and healthy, everyone. Take care.